This is Robin Hirsch, Minister of Culture, and you are listening to a Cornelia Street Cafe event on WNYC's Talk to Me podcast. Welcome to Cornelia Street Cafe. I think it's the end of Midsummer Night's Dream. I am sent with broom before to sweep the dust behind the door. This is Puck, otherwise known as Robin Goodfellow. I am Robin Goodfellow. Anyhow, it's my great pleasure to A, welcome all of you, B, to welcome the mysterious wizard of these proceedings, Andy Christie, who will suddenly materialize from who knows where.
Hello and welcome to the Lawyer Show. I hate talking after Robin talks. I just sound so stupid. I'm Andy, by the way. Thanks a lot for coming. I'm just going to take a couple of minutes just to explain how the show works. First, you'll hear four people getting up to tell short personal stories. Three of the people will be telling the truth completely, and one person will be making the entire thing up. And your job, in a nutshell, is to figure out which one of the four people is lying to you. So as you're listening, keep your ears open for things that you might want to ask questions about later, because you will have a chance to interrogate them. And then we will take a very, very short break, during which you'll mark your ballots. So you'll decide who you think is lying, and you'll mark the person. It's pretty simple. You'll mark the person you think is lying. Hold on to that. We'll come back. We'll have a kind of a multimedia presentation to blow your mind, and you'll find out who was lying. So we're going to start with the first person. I'm not going to do all the credentials and their history and everything. So please start clapping now, and don't stop until she gets here. Please welcome to the stage Leslie Goshko.
Thanks. So when I was in high school, I worked at this pizza parlor. And whenever any of the employees would give their two-week notice, the very next time they would show up for their shift, management would send them home and tell them to never bother coming back again. And I always thought that was really strange, and I just really thought it was rude. And when I asked, management explained to me that it was because in those last 2 weeks when people are, like, getting towards the end, you can't trust them because they do unusual things. And so it wasn't until, like, years later I kind of realized that there was some truth in that, because I found that, like, when one chapter of your life is coming to a close and another one is going to open, that in-between transitional period, that's when the crazy can happen. And so just like a marathon runner who's like maybe dehydrated and like they're getting a little delusional, you may find yourself standing in an abandoned field smoking weed out of a crack pipe with your 17-year-old students you teach. And you have to ask yourself, how did I get here? You know, this is not my beautiful wife. This is not my beautiful house. And it's time to reassess things. And 2 years prior to that incident occurring, I was a little inebriated at a cast party. We had just finished the musical Zombies from the Beyond. Thank you. And I was at this cast party, and this woman offered me a job to teach high school drama. And my answer to that was no, God, no. Because one, I've never wanted to be involved with the educational system, like, at all. Two, I'm really, really impatient with, like, explaining things to people. And three, not so much in love with the kiddos. And I told this woman that, and she kept trying to get me to take this job. And she's like, well, you'll have all your summer vacations, you know, and it's a steady, you know, paycheck, and you can do all of your performance stuff at night. And that all sounded really good. So, like, through my beer haze, I told her, you know, I would do an interview. And the next day, I found myself in her office signing a contract to be a high school drama teacher. And the gig actually, because I refer to teaching as a gig, the gig actually was good. Like, I actually really liked my students, and I liked everybody that I worked with, and I did get to perform at night, and I had my paycheck, and it was really good. But after, like, 2 years of teaching, I just hit this wall, and I just felt really restless, and I was tired of telling people about performing and, you know, following their hearts, and, like, here I am stuck, you know, in a classroom. And I had just gotten back from this trip from visiting New York, and I came back, and I'm like, now I have to talk about the miracle worker. Like, I don't want to do it. So I put in my resignation. But unlike the pizza parlor, they made me keep teaching. And so I was like, all right, this is my marathon. I'm going to trudge through. And everything was going good up until about a week and a half before school was done. And that's when I hit my mile 20 and my marathon brain kicked in. And it started making some decisions, starting with, let's get rid of all the curriculum and only teach class over the addictions and deaths of Saturday Night Live performers. And I was like, that's completely rational. Let's do that. And so the next day I walked into class and I told my class, like, put your books away. You're going to get a real education. And this class, God bless them, there was only 6 students in my drama class. And none of them wanted to be in a drama class. I had 2 boys who were, like, way too into Dungeons and Dragons. I had 2 girls who were formerly homeschooled. 1 gothic chick and 1 Jehovah's Witness who, around the school, they were affectionately called J-dubs. And so I told them, like, we were going to be focusing on the years 1975 to 1980 because that's when the real performers were there. And I taught them all of the names of the original Not Ready for Primetime players, but I wouldn't let them just say them. So every morning when we began class, we would sing their names. And so we would start class. We're like, Gilda, Garrett, Lorraine, Jane, John, Chevy, Dan, get off my lawn, bloop. And that was our song we started class with. And then I would write their names on the board, and I'd point to them, and they would scream things like, heroin, bulimia, you know, cancer. And I was like, yes, yes, you're learning. Getting to the end, trudge, trudge. And we would, like, deconstruct things like the Bass-O-Matic sketch, and we would do, like, characterizations of Mr. Bill, and, like, what does oh, no really mean? Like, really get into it. So one day, after we sing the opening song, we were just sitting there talking, and this girl brings up Guantanamo Bay. Except instead of saying Guantanamo Bay, she says Guantanamo Day. And we all laugh and have a little chuckle at this. And I'm like, oh, Guantanamo Day. Can you even imagine what that would be? Yes, can you imagine what that would be? And now we're past mile 20. Now we're in miles should not be around other humans. And that's when I decide what we're going to do to get to the end of the school year is to create a holiday around Guantanamo Bay. But we will call it Guantanamo Day. And that knocks out, like, 4 lesson plans. Like, that's the finish line. And so we start brainstorming, and we determine that all holidays have 4, like, crucial elements, which is food, music, decorations, and loved ones. And we cross off, like, loved ones right off the bat because it's been brought to my attention that apparently this might be misconstrued as being done in poor taste and people might not understand. So I was like, it's an observational holiday, but we just keep it between us. And then one of my homeschoolers tells me that, oh, my mom makes a mean crock pot a little smoky, so she's in charge of food. And then my other homeschooler tells me that she has, like, some leftover fabric from a skirt she made, of course. So I was like, you're in charge of making a flag. And then my J-dub tells me that, like, he's in a band, and I don't know what kind of bands Jehovah's Witnesses have, but I'm like, you're in charge of music. And then my gothic chick, she's very angry at the world, and she's like, I want to write a manifesto. I was like, have at it. And then my 2, like, D&D players, they don't really know what's going on, so I was just like, shh. So in the days leading up to Guantanamo Day, like, we do all of these, like, improvised scenes and sketches, and we rehearse in case anyone asks us questions like, why do you need a crock pot full of cocktail wieners for drama class? And our answer to everything is, we're having an end of the semester art celebration, which we think sounds, like, totally legit. No one can crack that. And this ends up being, like, the most involved my students have been in drama all semester, and they're really getting into it, and they come up to me and they say things like, Miss G, I'm so glad we did those sketches. My mom asked me what the flag was for, and I'm so glad you taught us to lie. And I'm like, it's not lying. That's acting. And it's like my Michelle Pfeiffer, like, Dangerous Minds, except they're not urban youth. They're, like, white homeschoolers. But so finally, Guantanamo Day arrives, and we all file into the classroom, and we lock the door. And we get in there, and it starts off with my goth chick getting up, and she reads her manifesto, and, like, she clearly states that this is not a waste of class time. This is to observe those who have been abused and all the injustices. And then we take that, and we tack it to the back of our flag, which is, like, blue and white checkered gingham, like very Dorothy Wizard of Oz, and it has a lion on it. I don't know where the lion came from. And we put that on the wall, and then my J-dub stands up, and he goes, although I'm very competent to write a song about Guantanamo Bay, I found a video that I think just shows it so much more freely. And we all get a little plate of little smokies and we're eating. And he opens up his laptop and it's just this video of, like, a 50-year-old man in his basement. And he's just strumming a guitar and he's going, maybe he's innocent. Maybe he's not. And it just, like, loops that over and over. And we're just sitting there eating. And finally the song stops. And it's just silence. And one of my dungeon masters breaks the silence and he goes, can we hear that again? And I was like, every one of you just got an A+ on your final. And like, I'm feeling so connected to these kids now. And so when some of them asked me later, like, hey, do you want to meet us for coffee later, Ms. G? I was like, of course I do. Like, we're friends now. And so I meet these kids at a coffee shop and I was like, ask me anything about my life. And I told them about like stuff I did in college and high school and like growing up. And they're like, oh, Ms. G, we're going to get you stoned. And I was like, no, no, that's not going to happen. That's not what this is about. And they go, well, Mr. E did it. And I wouldn't care, like, if another teacher got stoned with my students. Like, that's fine, whatever. Except Mr. E is my husband, who also teaches at school. And so since mentally I have, like, the peer pressure resistance of a five-year-old here, I was like, let's light up. And so we go out to this field behind this coffee shop, and there I am burning my fingers on a crack pipe with my students who have just made a holiday over the most insane thing ever. And I'm watching this chapter of my life come to a close, and I think, I don't think I could have finished this race any more perfectly. Thank you.
Leslie Goshko. Okay, you can also start clapping for the next guy, Robert Hurst.
Turn off that goddamn music. I'm not going to have any son of mine prancing around like a little faggot. Hi, I'm Robert Hurst, and I have father issues. My father had an 8th grade education, was a redneck, and we grew up in rural Louisiana. And I spent much of my time rebelling from his authoritative, physically violent rule by doing musical theater. I loved dancing, and I moved very, very well. And this I found when a large, an obese person moves well, people find that funny. So I capitalized on that with doing lots of musicals for a while. And my life went on, and I still enjoyed dancing, and I got to be in my 40s, and I got this pain in my ass that turned out I have, as my Russian doctor told me, says, Mr. Hurst, you have hip of 80-year-old man. So I had a hip replacement, and I sitting in rehab, I'm thinking, you know, what I need to do, even though my father's been long dead, is I need to do something rebellious, you know, to seize my life back from this man. And so I decided to go to Burning Man this past year. Luckily, my hip, groovy young girlfriend is from Los Angeles. Her parents, they have money, we can get tents, we can do all of this stuff. And she's got friends who are all in their theater. Their theater queens, for lack of a better name. And so they have a camp, and we're going to go meet them at Burning Man. And I don't know if you know what Burning Man is, but it's about 45,000 freaks in the desert doing God knows what to whoever knows what, and everyone's okay with it, and it's cool. And everybody wears costumes, and it's great fun, and there's lots of drugs and sex, and it's like a, you know, it's like Woodstock, but really wild and crazy. I don't know. And no real music other than techno. So so we get there, and we show up at the camp. And the camp is the camp called Little Crack Whores. Crack being a theme, apparently, this evening. But not crack in terms of smoking, but crack in terms of ass. And so the mascot is this little androgynous figure bent over, like kind of like the Coppertone girl with the, you know, thing going down. And I am immediately pegged as the straight boyfriend. And so everybody kind of is, they're very polite, everybody's very nice, but they're kind of, you know, very overly respectful. And I'm here to, you know, be crazy and have fun and party, you know. And so this is a great group of guys, and they're just wonderful. And you know that I'm in the right group because they have a separate tent just for costumes. And they don't have just costumes for the day. They have costumes for breakfast. They have costumes for lunch. They have costumes for the afternoon dance. They have pre-going out costumes. And they are amazing. And I figure I got to kind of break in and show them that I can let my freak flag fly. And so they're having a little crack whore party. And I conspire with my beautiful girlfriend to dress as a crack whore. And so she gets me a little jean, a skirt, and a blousy kind of peasant thing that really accentuates my bosoms. And I have this beautiful makeup on, and I unfortunately cut the little jeans short too much because my tighty-whities kind of peeked down in the front, which they loved. I was the belle of the ball, so to speak, or the balls of the belle, it's hard to say, but they loved it. It was really quite wonderful, and then I was, you know, I was one of the girls from then on. And now that I was one of the girls, I knew something that they liked me because this person came over and says, here, take this. What is it? It's a brownie. Brownie? Yeah, Mark sent it. Okay. And, of course, it, you know, it's a pot brownie. This is great. And I never really did many drugs, but I'm thinking, what way to stick it to the old man than doing drugs and hanging around with gays and doing who knows what kind of mayhem. But I had just been recovering from my my hip surgery. I've got a metal hip. And so I want to go dancing. There's the big out, kind of out at the edge of the desert, there are these big raves, like 5,000-6,000 people just getting kind of nuts. And two of Margot, my girlfriend's friend, Mark and Charlie, have some ecstasy. And I've never done ecstasy. But we're apparently going to go rolling, which is the lingo. And I say, okay, let's do this. So I pop one, and I'm thinking, well I got to have an outfit. So I get, Margot, what do you got? And she's got tights. So she's got these lovely zebra striped tights. So I put on the tights, and she's made me a blue fur, kind of, I call it my Cookie Monster coat. And I got a headband, and I got everything, and I'm just like decked out. I got my hiking boots. I'm going to go dancing in the desert. And I'm going out, and you hear the of the music. And there's 5,000-6,000 people out there. And, you know, and just these beautiful women, and most of them, God help them, are wearing next to nothing, and sometimes less than nothing. And I am just in heaven. And I don't know if you have done ecstasy before, but you feel really good. You feel sensual. And growing up, being really ashamed of my body, being overweight and feeling uncomfortable, and being 6 months out of having a hip replacement surgery, I'm feeling great. It's one of the nicknames of ecstasy is the love drug. And, you know, I was feeling a lot of love. Women, men would come up and they'd want to feel my coat. And they would just luxuriate in the blue fur on my body. And I loved that. And that's when I realized I really had to go to the bathroom. And I'm wearing white zebra-striped tights. It's not, you know, problems there. So I make it. And, of course, there's long lines because everybody else is doing ecstasy. And so everybody's got to go crap right now at this minute in the porta-johns out in the desert. And so eventually I go and I have a little bit of an accident, but luckily I had my tidy whities on. So I took those off and I'm feeling a little freer. And I get out there and Mark says, hey. And Mark's this beautiful man. He's Charlie's partner, and he's like 6'2". He looks like David Bowie, and he's from Trinidad, and he's got this great accent. And he's like, do you want another one? I'm like, yeah, I do. And I'm just dancing the night away. I don't know how much time, and I think it's laced with speed or something. And so I'm just dancing like a madman, and I'm not feeling any pain for the first time in a long, long time. And these two girls start dancing with me, and Mark wants to get a picture of this because he thinks it's funny because they are topless, right? And so he takes a picture of me watching them undress. And I'm holding, I actually, on my Facebook, have a picture of me holding this stuffed animal. And Mark thinks it's funny because these girls are just stripping down to their panties in front of me. And the ecstasy I was feeling is beyond belief. And you're thinking it's like sexual. Yeah, it was sexual. I admit that. But it was like, it was freedom. It was what I wanted, this freedom from my body that was failing. It was freedom from my issues, from my father, from all this shit, right? And so eventually my girlfriend gets tired. She goes back to the tent, and Mark and Charlie say they're going to babysit me, make sure I don't get in trouble. And I'm dancing and dancing. I don't know how long I'm dancing. And then I notice that everything starts to change. The sun starts coming up. And I'm still feeling no pain, and I'm feeling great. And it just hits me that by the time my mother was my age, she couldn't walk. She was in a wheelchair. And it just hit me, the floodgates, and I just started crying, just bawling, right? And my two little nymphette friends are concerned. They're like, what's wrong, man? What's wrong? And it's time that I had this hip replacement. I'm old. I shouldn't be here. I feel stupid. And they just they gave me this big hug. And he said, let's get naked. I said, what? take off your coat. And I said, what? And they started taking off my coat. And I was so grateful. And I said, and they took off my coat. And I was like, you know, I'm hairy. I'm like, things jiggle that shouldn't jiggle. And then they took off their panties and they wanted to take off my tights. And I was looking, the sun come up, and I'm 44 years old, and I'm like, yes. Yes. And there I was, 44 years old, with a metal hip, dancing with two beautiful naked ladies. And I was naked as a jaybird. Thank you.
Robert Hirsch. Okay, next person up to the stage, please start clapping now as she walks up here from way over in Connecticut right now. Joanne Solomon.
So I wake up to the same whistle that I wake up to every time I visit my boyfriend who lives in Mexico City. It's the tamale whistle. And they blow a whistle, and then somebody from the street's like, tamales, maquinas. I wake up to this sound every time I visit him for the last 4 years. I'm in Mexico City about 6 months out of my year. And this particular morning, he's already dressed for work, and he's sitting at the edge of the bed, and he says, oh, punk, either you have to leave today or I have to leave today. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, no, you have to go or I have to go. I'm like, no, I understood what you said, but I'm supposed to be here for 4 more months. And no, you have to go or I have to go. And I'm like, what? This is crazy. He's like, oh, you know, we are in crisis, and you know. And he keeps repeating, you have to go or I have to go. And then I'm in like such a frantic rage that I pack my bags. And he's like, don't do this, not like this. And I'm like, well, then can I stay? And he says, no, you have to go. I'm like, I know the thing. And so 10 minutes later, I am on the streets of Mexico City with my two suitcases. And I'm bawling my eyes out. And I don't know what to do. I have a friend that lives in a nearby building, so I went to her building and I buzzed, and she buzzed me up, and I told her the story, and I was crying, and I was like, Megan, I don't have it in me to go through a breakup again like I did the last time, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And there's this quote from the recesses of my brain, which I thought was Eleanor Roosevelt. It turns out it's not. Which is accept defeat with the grace of a woman and not the grief of a child. And I'm just like hearing like grace of a woman, grace of a woman. And I decide not to go back to New York, but that I should go to Cancun and walk on the beach and have a couple days to reflect so that when I do go back to New York, there'll be a little bit of distance and I can be calmer and be graceful like a woman is graceful. So I book a flight to Cancun, and I check into a youth hostel that's supposed to have this great communal feel to it. And I meet this guy from the UK who works for a company called Green Heart. And he is in Mexico to pass around little green heart stickers to promote ecotourism. And this guy asks me if I would like to have a drink with him. And I say, okay. And we go out for a drink. And I watch him like clumsily in Spanish hand out these sticker hearts. And all these Mexican people are like, well, what is this? And and then they would sort of take the heart and thank him. And we spend the whole night talking. And this poor guy, I'm like talking about my ex-boyfriend. And he's talking about how like he hasn't dated in a while. And it's very clear for me, like we go back to the youth hostel and he says, would you like a cheeky foot rub on the roof? And I'm like, no, I don't want a cheeky foot rub. The cheeky foot rub is the last thing I want. And I go to bed in this dormitory room in the youth hostel. And there's like 14 beds, and there's just a lot of drunks from Denmark snoring, and I'm still thinking like, grace of a woman, grace of a woman. It's just going over and over in my head. I can't handle the, like, drunken snoring, and in the middle of the night, I go downstairs and I book my flight back to New York, but the earliest I can get back is on Sunday. I have a whole day to kill. So in the morning I get up and I'm like changing, and everyone's talking about how trash they were last night. I mean, granted, everyone's 21 and I'm 40, so I have like no business being in this youth hostel with people asking me what my major is. But I just thought I was alone and it'd be a good way for me to meet people. And cheeky foot rub guy's like, would you like, there's an island nearby. Would you like to go to this island? I hear it's really beautiful. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll go to the island. I go to this island called Isla Mujeres, which is 20 minutes away from Cancun, and I walk into this bar and I meet this beautiful bartender, also in his 20s, and he's very grounded and earthy, and he looks at me and he says, you know, why don't you stay here on this island? It's helped heal a lot of people that I know. And then, like, suddenly I'm in a Lost episode, and it felt right. And I, like, look over, and Cheeky Foot Rub Guy's, like, giving another green heart to another restaurant owner. And I'm, like, thinking about, like, spending, like, the ferry ride back with that guy. And I was like, you know what? I tell Cheeky Foot Rub Guy, I said, I'm going to stay here on the island. The bartender had convinced me that I had time in the morning to go back, get my stuff, and make it to the airport. So I go out with the bartenders that night. I'm not going to lie to you. I did have sort of a weird Y tu mama también fantasy. And his other friend was like, had so much energy and was like really cute. And I went back to their place when the restaurant closed, and we got stoned and we played with the dog. And I listened to all these great stories about how they believe this dog was one of their grandparents. And it was just like, I had like the greatest night. And they introduced me to Mario, and Mario's from Rome, and he plays the saxophone, and he works in a bakery in Rome, and he had worked his whole life paying for his brother and sister to go to college, and now it was his time. And it was just like this, it was a perfect night. And somewhere between the pot and the saxophone playing, all that jazz fusion, they had convinced me to cancel my flight entirely and stay on the island, which I did. I went back to Cancun. I picked up my stuff. I told everybody at the youth hostel, I'm like, go to that island. That island's amazing. And I went back out to the island. And I go to the bar, and the bartenders that day introduced me to three French Canadian girls who have just gone through divorces. It was like my target social group. And then walks in one of the guys from the youth hostel in Cancun, and his name's Huey, and he's a surfer from California. And he sits down, and like within 5 minutes, he's telling me this story about how he had traveled to Greece for the first time, and that he rented a moped and was riding the moped into the sunset. And he thought, God, my mother would have been so proud of me had she been alive. And Huey burst into tears, and I told him it was okay, and he gave me a hug. And he asked me if I'd like to go to dinner later. And I said, I'm not sure. I think I'm going to go dancing with the French girls. And he was pretty okay with my non-committal answer. I went for a drink at sunset, and there was an older man in his late 60s sitting there, and he asked me what book I was reading, and then he said, I don't know how else to say this, but I've been on my yacht for 6 months, and I'd sure like some company. Would you like to go to dinner? And again, I said, well, I'm kind of having dinner with my other friend, but if you'd like, you can come along. And he was like, all right, I just might do that. And I'm walking back to my hotel when another gentleman asked me for directions. And it turns out he's a writer. He has a book called The Well-Fed Writer, which helps writers make money from commercial writing. And I'm a writer, and he's a writer, and he grew up in New York, well, Long Island. And would I like to have dinner? And I said, well, okay, sure, but it has to be with these other two dudes that I've met earlier in the day. So by 7 p.m., we're like roaming around this island with these three guys, ranging in age from 40 to 70, maybe. And I like know it's gonna go downhill because we go to a Moroccan restaurant, and the older gentleman's like, "This is the biggest tourist trap on the island." And the Kiwi's like, "Well, I ate here for lunch yesterday. It's like the best meal I've had in months. And anyway, I think you're just afraid of couscous." And so there's this like running tension between these two gentlemen. And dinner is really uncomfortable. The older gentleman is like telling us about all the exotic fish he's seen on all his journeys on his sailboat. And the younger gentleman's like, "Well, I don't see a lot of fish because I have one lung." And the older gentleman's like, "Why do you have one lung?" He's like, "Well, as I told my doctors, like, I was addicted to crack for 10 years. I do a lot of PCP, crystal meth." And the doctors are like, "Is that it?" And I'm like, "Isn't that enough?" And the older gentleman's like, "Yes, that's enough." Somehow, by default, this evening ends with me making out with Bowerman, the middle guy. And I like try to think about why that is, and it's because he was wearing a black shirt. I'm a sucker for a dude in a black shirt. That's pretty much what it comes down to. But in the morning, when I see him again, well, you know, we kiss, and then like he like stops the kiss, and then he kind of pulls out his age and like lets his Long Island hang out because he like opens this big box of Tic Tacs and he pours some Tic Tacs into his hand and like takes it and then goes back in for the kiss. And then we kiss a little bit, and then he stops me and he says, "You're just scrumptious." And I like sobered up so fast. I was like, "I will see you tomorrow." And so when I see him the next day, hoping that he's still kind of cute or still wearing that shirt, he has a white t-shirt on, and it's like tucked into his pants, his vacation linen vacation pants. And Huey's like, "That guy really needs to untuck his shirt." And so I end up like telling Bowerman, "Look, I'm in no place for this." And he says, "Oh, I saw that coming." And I was like, "Well, then maybe you shouldn't have gotten me drunk." And then in baby talk, he grabs me and he says, "I am a bad boy." And he goes in for another kiss. And I was like, "No!" So I've been on this island like 4 days, and I've had a relationship and a breakup and a group of friends, and I hear my other friend play music. And I get into this routine that it's just like quite lovely. I run in the morning, and I dance with the Frenchies, and Huey leaves about 6 o'clock because he doesn't like to be around alcoholics. And you know, I get stoned with the bartenders at night. And it dawns on me like that I could stay there forever, except it seems to be a thing on this island, you know, and I have to get back to work too, so I can't stay there forever. But it seems to be on this island for me that like people are either filled with like promise or adventure. It's like the first stop of their world tour where all these great things are going to happen. Or people are just ridiculously sad, 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 and they fall under the wherever you go, there you are category, because there's something about them that they come to the island and they pretend to be other people. And I'm not excluding myself from this category, but there was a guy, for instance, from Alabama named Captain Banana, and he introduced himself as Captain Banana, and I was like, "You can call me Captain Banana." And I was like, "No, I won't ever call you." And this guy was there to teach young girls how to give proper Thai massages. And so he had like a gaggle of young women that he met at the youth hostel, and he would test out all his work on these young women, like shake them out in their bikinis on the beach. He was like disgusting everyone. Like we would walk by and somebody would be like, "Oh, Capitan Banana." He was just horrible. And you know, the last week I was there, I took a snorkeling trip, and it was a perfect example of the scenario I was talking about. There was like these two young Australian brothers, and they were like really strapping, and then they spoke fluent Japanese, and they had just climbed Machu Picchu with their parents. And they were taking a break from law school because they were going to open an NGO in Central America. And then there was a woman who showed up late for the 8-hour snorkeling trip in nothing but her bathing suit, like no extra protection, no hat, completely drunk, from Chicago. She had like crazy white teeth and bug bites all over her face. And it's as if she had like gotten drunk the night before and fallen asleep on the beach and was like, woke up and was like, "Oh, my snorkeling trip's today," and decided to make it anyway. So I had these two extremes. I'm looking at these young brothers, and I'm looking at this older woman, and I know I'm not the, I'm going to change the world with my ideals woman, but I also know, like, I'm swimming very far away from the drunk Chicago lady with the bug bites on her face. You know, if you look at a picture of me in this week, you would not think that I had just had a breakup, because they're all like with a cocktail in hand or like dancing with a bunch of guys. You know, this quote, like, grace of a woman, like, kept going. And it's not very graceful, this picture of me in a bar, drunk, dancing. But it's a hell of a lot more graceful than me in my bathroom Facebook stalking my ex-boyfriend. I had a hard time these last couple months in New York. And there's another quote that has helped me through, which is from this fine literary work called Analyze This, the Movie, where Billy Crystal is talking to a weeping mob boss, Robert De Niro, and he's like, take all this sadness and turn it into a nice, healthy rage. And I wake up in the middle of the night about 4 weeks ago, and I book a flight to Isla Mujeres. You know, I'm so tired of my breakups where all my boyfriends get the real estate. Like, in the past, in my breakups, Michael got Los Angeles, and Adam got all of Brooklyn and Long Island City. And for me, well, I fucking got Isla Mujeres. Thank you.
Joanne Solomon. You can start clapping for the last person to tell a story. Emily.
Hi. So this story takes place in Nice, France. And my two friends were wearing their little tiny itsy-bitsy bikinis. And I had just graduated from the one piece to the tankini, showing exactly about half an inch of flesh when I was stretching. And we get there, and we're very excited, and there is just beautiful blue water and golden sand everywhere. And as we're looking, we also notice that there are lots of beautiful brown pairs of boobs, just as far as the eye could see. And I was like, oh, God, I forgot that they go topless here. And my friend Kate goes, yay, now I don't have to worry about my tan lines, and pretty much drops all her beach paraphernalia and her bikini top simultaneously. So my other friend Allie and I have a discussion, a full discussion, with the pros and cons of the topless situation, whether we're going to do it or not. And in the end, we decide, okay, let's do this. So we take our tops off, and we start putting sunscreen on. And very quickly, this has gone from a nice family-friendly afternoon to a live topless show. And I feel very bad because I happen to have the biggest boobs of the group, which is fine, but they are very, very white because they had never seen the sun before. And so the sun would reflect off of my boobs out to the other people sitting on the beach, and they would be confused. And I would be sad because I had become a pair of human headlights. But Allie and Kate had gotten very comfortable with this. They're lying down. Their toes are tapping in the sand. They're taking a nap. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking about my decisions and thinking all the angst from my childhood, if I'm good enough, if I'm thin enough. All of that is just going through my head, and I'm trying not to cover my boobs because every time I look down, I realize my hands are right here, and that's really drawing attention. So I take them down, and I'm like, are my nipples too big? Are one of my boobs bigger than the other? Do they point in two different directions? Like, I'm kind of like a broken compass. Can I look at someone else's boobs to try and figure this out? Am I staring at someone's boobs right now while I'm trying to figure out if this is okay? And if so, how long have I been staring at their boobs? So all this is going through my mind, and I am not getting tanned very quickly, so nothing is getting any better. And I'm trying to relax, and all of a sudden, a French gentleman comes over, and I hear bonjour. And I'm like, oh, crap, come on. And he's wearing a Speedo, so he's actually technically wearing less than I am, so I should feel comfortable, but I don't. And I'm like, oh, I only speak English. He's like, hey, speak a little bit of English. And I was like, hey, Kate, who was asleep next to me, wake up, you have a visitor. And I said to my friend Allie, I think we should go to the bathroom. And so she goes, okay. And I immediately put my top on because I was looking for an excuse. And Allie, just boobs flopping in the wind, gets up. And we go and we walk to the bathroom. She's like, wow, this is some culture, huh? And I'm like, yes, it is. And we get to the bathroom and Allie goes in first. And it actually was one of those bathrooms where you have to pay. She's like, God, you can't get anything for free around here. And I'm like, I know. So she puts her franc in and she goes into the bathroom and she's taking her time and that's fine. And she gets out and she holds the door for me and I go in. and I'm looking in the mirror, and I'm just trying to get comfortable. I just can't get comfortable with this whole topless thing. I'm very American that way, I guess. Very prude. And I'm like, you know what? It's not even a big deal. You know, like, no one's paying any attention. And I feel something on the back of my neck, like a drop of water, I hope. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. And then I start to see something coming out of the walls. And then I realize that it's soap. And then I realize that I had forgotten to pay because Allie had held the door open for me. And then I realized that it was a self-cleaning toilet. And then I realized that it was going to be self-cleaning me if I didn't figure out a way to get out. So I'm trying to stay calm, and I'm looking for something, some exit. I'm trying the door. Nothing is working. There is soap. The soap is coming out. And it doesn't smell like lavender or vanilla or puppies. It smells like chemicals, okay? Because that is what this bathroom does. It self-cleans. And I am starting to freak out, and I am starting to scream bloody murder, and I am starting to wonder why I don't hear Allie running, "I'll get help," like my own personal Lassie, but I don't hear anything. And I am yelling, and I am trying to look for exits, and that's when I think, oh my God, this better not be the way that I die. This is a sad way to die, because I have thought about how I'm going to die, and I thought it would be more noble, you know, like running into a burning building and trying to save a child, or pushing a puppy out of the way on the street and then getting hit. But the best case scenario, as far as this being a big production, is that it takes me a really long time, and the French police surround it, and they say, "Come out with your hands up and a franc to pay." And then I'd say something profound like, "Fuck you, Frenchie." Sorry, kids. And then I'd die in a hail of bullets. That's what I imagined would happen. And then all of a sudden, I saw a big red button that said sortie. And I was like, hey, maybe that one will work. So I hit the button, and in slow motion, the door opened. And I ran out and took a big, fresh breath of non-soapy air. And then to the right, right next to the porta potty, I see Allie on the floor in a fit of giggles, just rolling around. And I was like, "You weren't gonna help me?" And she's like, "Oh, I figured you'd be fine eventually." I felt like I had been in there for hours. I had been in there for a minute and 45 seconds. So we're walking back. And I am so angry at her. And she's like, "Oh, come on, you would have been fine." And we get back to our blanket, and Cade and Francois are having a nice discussion. And apparently we're going to go to a club later. And I'm just so happy that I am not dead inside that porta potty. And I look around, and, you know, there are a lot of boobs. There are a lot of boobs surrounding me at this beach. And I realized something as I took some time to actually look. There were some really nice, pert, brown breasts. There were also some very saggy, very wrinkly, very weathered-looking boobs. And it was then that I thought, you know what? I can do this too. So I looked at my friends and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to go for a swim. And I took off my top and I took another fresh breath of air and I let my very white, very clean breasts out to the beach. Thank you.
Emily Epstein. Anybody buy that one?
Excellent, yeah.
Raise your hand if you have a question, and we will attempt to answer it. Yes.
This is for Leslie. How many of your students went behind to smoke with you?
Three.
Okay, you get how this works? Now we're just going to say as little as possible to answer the question. Three.
It was the girls. I went with the girls.
Anybody else? Yep, go ahead.
Is Goshko your maiden name?
Yes. Yes, it is my maiden name. I'm giving very short terms. Yes, it is.
Well, I thought you said that your husband's name is Mr. E.
Oh, young, fresh minds.
I'm a liberal woman. I don't need to take his name. I never took his name when we got married, so because Goshko is a kick-ass name.
Yeah, anybody else with a question? Back there?
Robert, you said your hip was metal?
I don't know quite the... I'm assuming it's titanium of some sort. It goes off when I go through airports.
Is it a titanium screw, or is the hip titanium?
You know, I haven't talked to my doctor. I
How
know
do
that
not
it's
know about what's drilled in your body? Are you serious? Come on.
I don't... I know I have a 10-inch scar on my hip, and I set metal alarms off.
Let's see it.
And I've seen it in an x-ray. Really? Because I will, you know.
Okay, everybody want their T-shirts right now? yeah, back there.
Emily, what color was your bathing suit?
It was actually a blue and white stripe situation. It was lovely.
If she had said pink and green.
Hi, Joanne. What month did this take place?
February.
Okay.
And we'll be back there next February. I want to know when I should book my flight. You have a black shirt? Okay, yes.
Leslie, what was the name of the principal at your school?
Oh, damn. Something with an S? I don't really remember, honestly. I know.
I was smoking weed. I don't know.
Real dean's list. Huh?
I don't know. Well, even if I remember, I don't know if I'd want to say, just because I don't want to implicate the school. I really honestly don't remember.
Yes.
What year did you teach this class?
I left in 2007. I taught for 2 years, so I started in 2005.
Does that make sense? Kind of. Yeah, Guantanamo. Yeah.
Joanne, quickly, what was the toad's name who dumped you, his real name, and what did you call him?
My ex-boyfriend?
Yes.
He's named Alejandro Costabile, and he calls me punk.
That's endearing. And I heard no feminist judgment in calling him Toad there. Yeah.
This is for Robert. What towns did you drive through to get a Burning Man?
It's the Black Rock Desert, and there are a bunch of little towns. It's with a G. I really don't remember. I didn't drive, if that makes my girlfriend drove. We drove from Los Angeles. It was a long drive. Mm-hmm. And we stopped at Reno. And then it's all a little back road, and you go a little very small. We go through. There's only one real little town, and then you go through a little stuff before you get to this little town, right. Which is the last. It's G. It's like it's. I don't know. I don't know Nevada.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the Black Rock Desert.
If I could paraphrase the answer, who knows? Who knows?
Know.
We're doing all.
Stop there.
We're doing
know.
All answers with just initials tonight. I think it's Mr. S and some town with a G, and yeah.
Robert, do you remember there being police officers at Burning Man?
There's the Black Rock Rangers, which wear lovely little kilts. Is that what you mean? there were a lot undercover cops, I was told, looking for people doing drugs.
Everybody's nodding up there. You've opened.
But
to Burning.
I did.
You've
I did not.
Burning, yeah.
I did not see actual like rain. You know, state trooper types. But I'm assuming they were there, yeah. Undercover. I guess.
This question is for Robert. What drugs did you take after your hip replacement surgery?
Well, I had
specific.
An epidural for the surgery, which piped in morphine. And then I went downgraded to Percocets, and now I'm doing Tramadol. And my hip replacement was glued in, by the way, if you want to know the truth.
This is for Emily. Emily, when did you visit France? What year?
2001.
Bam! Okay.
Wow.
This is for Leslie. I just wanted, will you explain the crack pipe a little more? Like, which one of your students had it? Is there a story behind it? And how did you feel smoking marijuana from fucking crack
pipe? A three-parter. So I don't usually smoke crack, so they told me it was a crack pipe. She said she had broken she had a glass one. I guess, and I usually don't smoke weed either. But so she said she had broken her glass one, and so she had this. It was like a little metal square thing. So when we held it, you know, and you light it up, it just burn the F out of your fingers, children.
Did you have a question?
I think it's for Leslie.
I only ask her because she has asked questions at previous shows, and I love her voice. Hold on.
Leslie.
Yes.
Where was your high school? Where did you teach?
Well, like I said, like I don't want to say where it was, like this, Oklahoma.
Okay, a state beginning with an O. Yes.
Somewhere in the U.S.
Yep.
Joanne, what kind of dogs did the bartenders have?
A white bulldog named Milagros.
Ha 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 Oh, yeah, follow up.
An English bulldog or a French bulldog?
Oh, my God. I don't need, I'm so I am ignorant. I don't know the difference.
An English bulldog or a French bulldog?
I don't know the difference.
She doesn't know the difference. Yeah.
Robert, can you describe and exactly what the ecstasy looked like that you took?
It was dark, and it was just as a little pill. Looked almost like an aspirin, probably a little smaller, a little fatter.
Mine was always like the size of a car battery. Is that what it looks like?
Probably wasn't I was ecstasy told that then. It wasn't the best, but it did the job for me, I guess.
Yes.
Also for Robert, I just wanted to know, will you remind me of the names of Margot's two friends?
Mark and Charlie? Okay.
Well done. Somebody asked that same question in 2 minutes. Yeah.
It's for Emily. Emily, how does soap come out of a wall?
To be honest, I was a little traumatized as it was happening, and it happened kind of fast, but it was sort of coming down through the ceiling, out through the sides, out of a spray situation.
Ugh.
It was a spray situation. That's about the best I can give you.
Was it oozing down the walls or spraying
out? It was
out
coming
the
down
the
wall, but then there were also like nozzles that sort of sprayed like a mist of soapy sadness.
There's some like huge metaphor there. I don't know what it is.
Joanne, you said that you were in New Mexico for just 6 months.
Mexico, like, not New Mexico.
Oh, Mexico. But how did you manage to just be there for 6 months without a job?
I work at a university, and I'm able to take semesters off.
Answer your question? Snap. Okay. Maybe like two more questions. Yeah.
This is for Leslie. Are you still married to Mr. E?
I am. It's going to be 6 years this summer.
I have a
right before the divorce. No. Yes, I am.
I have a follow-up. Sorry. Did you ask him why he hadn't told you he got high with the kids?
Yeah, I was actually... Thank you for asking, because he's here, and I can put it publicly. Yeah, I did. I was just like... Well, I didn't believe them when they told me. I thought they were just trying to, like, get me high. And so I did it, though, anyways. And then, and then when I came home, I asked him, I was like, did you smoke weed with the students? And he just went... He's a very like quiet guy. I honestly don't think he would have told me if I hadn't have found out. And that's how marriage lasts.
Right, right. That's not a quiet guy. That's just a husband. He wouldn't have told me unless I found out. So ethical. One more question,
Robert. What did happen to your caretakers? The guys who were supposed to be watching you and making sure you didn't get in trouble.
They were making out.
Just. Very quickly, if you can clap, if you picked the first person up, Leslie Goshko, if you thought she was lying about number two, Robert and the Burning Man hold stripper thing. Joanne being dumped and spending the rest of her time on it. Very, very interesting. And fourth person up, Emily getting trapped in a self-cleaning toilet. So essentially, you think everybody was lying, it sounds like. But it sounds heavily weighted toward Joanne's heartbreaking story. You people have no hearts. Okay, so prepare yourself to be shocked. And good luck, everybody. Robert.